Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 315th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Courtney. I'm Warren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got our pal Brenna Malloy on the show. She's got a great story about how she started off in film school doing the thing and has quickly skyrocketed into directing 13 episodes of network television over the course of the pandemic. It's an awesome story about what it takes to be a successful network director, how to prepare, how to make the most out of those moments and those opportunities. And I think kind of an overall mindset of success that is not at all Tony Robbins-y or guru-y or any of that stuff. Brenna's a person who is confident, but humble and working hard to do the best work that she can.
And I think she's doing some of the bigger network shows. You know, she does Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, 911, giant set pieces, big action things, big cast.
Explosions. Yeah, huge casts. Yeah,
probably an insane amount of vehicles and stunts and cool gear. It's a fun one. I really am quite inspired by her story. Something she told us off the mic, but that is really interesting, is it all started with a short film she made. And she said that she still today gets jobs, TV directing jobs, based off of her short film, opposed to sending episodes of her shows. Kind of makes sense, right? You send a 20-minute short instead of a 44-minute TV episode. It's easier to watch.
And also, you know those episodes of TV are good. If you know a director has done X number of episodes over multiple seasons of a network TV show, you kind of don't need to watch them unless they're meant to stand out in some way. There are very specific ways in which you can push an envelope on a show like that, but like they need to feel consistent within the world of the show. I guess what I'm saying is that like this is an opportunity to say something additional about Brenna's voice and Brenna's point of view because you've got this awesome backdrop of network television, which we're all at least vaguely and most likely very specifically aware of.
And speaking of Chicago, our editor, Noah Bayshore, is a Chicagoan. This show that you're listening to right now was edited in Chicago. If you're a filmmaker in Chicago and you're working on cool things, I know our editor is looking to link up with some other Chicago filmmakers. So
hardworking, talented dude. So for real, message us.
Yeah, justshootitpod@gmail.com.
You know what? I'll say this. If you message Noah and you end up working on something, I will subsidize a free Just Shoot It hat.
Will I also be subsidizing this? Or will you subsidize half a hat?
Would you like to subsidize half a hat or shall I pay for the whole thing?
I'll pay for it out of the money I get from you for winning my bet about when your next feature will be made.
Well, I've got a meeting on Friday that will help me determine how likely I'm going to be out $100. We'll see.
Anyhow, email us justshootitpod@gmail.com and we'll get it to Noah if you want to meet another filmmaker in Chicago. And the other thing you can do if you are feeling like interacting with us in some way is you can go to patreon.com/justshootitpod where you can give us $1 or $5 or $15 if you'd like a non-subsidized Just Shoot It podcast hat. It's a way that you can help support the show if you feel like you get anything out of it. We have like 315 episodes. If you literally got something out of two episodes, I feel like that would be worth $1 a month. For 12 months, it's $12. Go to patreon.com/justshootitpod and check out the easiest way you can support the podcast. Anything else?
That's it. Without further ado, let's hop into our conversation with Brenna, potentially after a few ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Brenna Malloy on the mic. Welcome to Just Shoot It, Brenna.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Very excited to make this work. You're in Chicago.
I'm in Chicago and I flew in today, which wasn't the plan originally. But thanks to COVID, everything changes all the time.
You know what's funny, Brenna? I saved this anecdote for the mic. I was on a shoot last week and our boom operator went to Chapman, which is your alma mater, and seemed to be about your age. And I was like, oh, do you know Brenna? Do you know Brenna Malloy? And he's said yes and had nice things to say about you. And he's like, yeah, we call her Chicago Brenna now because she is in Chicago all the time.
Who and was this?
His name is Will.
Oh, yes, Will. I know Will. I didn't know him when he had purple hair. Hi, Will.
We call him Anaheim Will.
Anaheim Will. Yep, makes sense.
But here you are in Chicago because you were on a never-ending hot streak of shooting network television in Chicago.
Knock on wood on that one. I just have this, like, ever since I started doing TV, I've just had this voice whispering in my ear, it's all gonna end. I just don't know when.
Well, I hope this wasn't the jinx. I hope we don't look back on this.
I hope so too.
That won't be the case.
Right now I'm on Chicago Fire, which I just did one of. So I did one, had about a week off, and now I'm back for another one. And this is the show that gave me my first TV job. So I love working with these guys. And this will be my fifth Chicago Fire.
You're living in this procedural world. So it's Chicago Fire. What are the other shows that you direct?
So I've done all my work so far at two different companies, Dick Wolf's company, where I've done Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, and then a show called FBI. The other company I've worked for is Ryan Murphy's company, where I've done 911 and 911 Lone Star.
Well, so I met you, Brenna, actually at Matt's baby shower. We were talking about your TV directing and how you directed so many episodes of TV in such a short amount of time. Like, you started kind of like right before COVID, right?
I did my first episode in February 2020 and it aired, I want to say March 18th, 2020, which is obviously we all know what we were doing then. And I was just like, I'm never going to work again. Wow. I did one episode and I'm retiring forever as a professional director. And then about 6 months later, I got a call from 911 and it's been pretty nonstop since then.
And just to remind people of like the way that network TV was working back then and kind of still is, frankly, is that like a show like that, that has a good number of episodes. Yeah. Like how many episodes of Chicago Fire do they do in a season? Like 20?
I think they did between 21 and like 25 every season.
Yeah, so a substantial number of shows. And before COVID, you would get like a director would do a handful of episodes every season, but like they would kind of cycle through things, people a little bit more. But because of COVID and because of the precautions, they started kind of like bubbling you up. You would do multiple episodes. And so there would be fewer directors on each season, basically, as a result. So I remember at the time it was like especially tricky because even though you had nailed that first episode, it felt like, oh, well, they'll probably just have a few old hands just mop up the season for them just to keep it convenient.
I know with a lot of shows, the plan, like right when things started back up again and it was all very uncertain and scary, the plan was to bring in directors who they were very familiar with, who they could depend on because of all the work they've done before that. And so that was part of the reason why I thought it would never work again, because sort of that window to book your second episode was passing for me. I feel just lucky that I got a second shot.
Do you have any insight or any intel as to why they decided to bring you back for that second episode?
So my second episode was actually at another show that I had shadowed a few years before. We can get into it because I actually think how it happened was like the perfect marriage of my agents and me laying groundwork from years before and that paying off. And so that second episode at 911, I did. And then I don't know if, you know, it getting out that I had gotten hired somewhere else helped me. You never know what happens behind the scenes, but it was around that time that I got booked for more episodes of Chicago Fire.
So what was the groundwork that you guys laid?
I did a program called the Ryan Murphy Half Initiative, which is something that they put basically one directing mentee on every episode that they produce. And I shadowed at 911 and I shadowed the producing director. And I've really worked hard when I was shadowing, prepping the episode as though I was directing it myself and engaging with the producing director, but also not annoying him and just... I think I made it clear what my approach would be as a director. And we had a discussion after I shadowed and he kind of said, you know, look, I'd love to hire you now. It's very hard for me to put forward first-time directors. If you can go out and get an episode somewhere else, I'd have a much bigger chance of pitching you here. And it was kind of one of those things. He's a great guy, this producing director. His name's Brad Beaker. You guys should talk to him. He got his start as an editor and he's fantastic. But it was one of those things you hear as an up and coming director who's like making no money and has no prospects. And you're like, okay, I will never hear from this person again.
Cool, thanks. Yeah, well, it feels like a brush off in a certain sense, right?
Right. And also like he's your best chance to get an episode and he's saying, he won't give
go
an episode
somewhere else
unless you get another episode.
But to his credit, everything he said is came true. I mean, I booked this episode of Chicago Fire. He was ecstatic for me. I kept in touch with him, but not in an overt way. Like I just would send him an email like, hey, I'm directing this show. Hope all is well. Very short because he's a busy guy. He said, congratulations, you know, and then the pandemic hit. And it was, you know, 6 months into not working and the agents I had signed with right before the pandemic started, one of them called me and said, would you be interested in doing 911? I was like, I would be interested in working, especially at 911, since I know and love those guys. And at the same time, Brad had put my name forward to the showrunner. And so it was just this really nice, you know, meeting of the work I had done already and the connections I had made and my agents like being on top of it.
I find that that's like so many stories of people getting their foot in the door are those where two different angles like coincide with a, you know, a good work sample. Like they know you're capable and they don't want to vouch for you 100% by themselves and someone else doesn't want to vouch for you 100% by themselves. But when two people are vouching for you from like different places, that's like when the magic happens.
That certainly was the case with getting my second episode. And when I was meeting with agents after I booked Chicago Fire, but hadn't directed yet, in my first meeting, with the agents I ended up signing with, I'm at Verve, they were very honest. And they were like, look, we think you're really talented. We see a big future for you. But the reality is, you know, booking you on episodes will happen when our more experienced directors back out at the last minute and we have to fill the spot. As far as I know, that's what happened with this 911, is they repped another director who was supposed to direct that episode. They had to back out for whatever reason, and they put my name forward.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Can you tell us like a tiny bit about like prepping? When you say you prepped an entire episode as if you're going to shoot it, what does that mean? You were like making a shot list? You were telling the costume designer what people should wear? What do you mean?
It was a lot of talking to myself in my head. So I sat in on all the prep meetings and was on set next to Brad while he was directing. And anytime a question was asked, I would answer it in my head to myself and then compare it to how Brad answered. And I kind of did that throughout the entire process, including talking to actors, talking to the DP. And then I also storyboarded the entire episode by hand, and I cannot draw, but it was something active for me to do while I was sitting there, you know, for 16 hours a day watching someone else work.
You know what else I love about that, Brenna, is that there's evidence of that thought process and work, right? Like, it's easy for a showrunner to, you know, walk past you as you're listening intently to, you know, the director answer a question and, you know, see you off in space and, you know, you're rehearsing what you would have said in that moment. But there's no way you can tell that, or if you're thinking about like what you're going to do that night, you know what I mean? Like wondering what time wrap is. But like, oh, here's the storyboards I put together because I've been thinking about this so much and I wanted to put it down on paper. There is something to be said about just having evidence. You know what I mean? Having something physical to be like, hey, I've been thinking about it really hard. Here is the result of that work in some way. And I can, and it prompts questions of like, why did you put the camera here? Well, because I remember when someone asked this question, they said X, Y, and Z. So this is why I thought I would put it there or whatever. It's just a conversation piece, but you can't have that conversation piece if everything is internal.
But did you board? You made the storyboards before the shoot?
No, I was doing stuff before, and I was hand drawing storyboards while we were on set of the scenes we were shooting. But Matt, you touch on something which I think is really important for people who are shadowing. The goal of me storyboarding wasn't as like a performative act so people could see I was working hard, but that is what it became. Is people saw I was working hard. And I think they have so many shadows come through. You know, a lot of them are fantastic, but if a portion of them are scrolling through Instagram all day, you're going to notice that. And then when a director comes along who's totally engaged, it does set a different tone in the village area.
So, sorry, so you're just sitting there like, in the director's chair in Video Village, like with a notepad and just drawing storyboards?
I had printed out blank storyboard sheets, and then I was penciling storyboards the entire shoot for the most part. And sometimes I would bring what I had and then see how Brad shot it and then draw the shots that he did. And it was great. I mean, I totally absorbed the visual language of that show through doing that.
We had previous guest Payman Benz on kind of a long while ago now, but the big takeaway I had from him was that whenever he was going to approach a new show, he would watch a handful of episodes and then write the shot lists for those episodes. So then he knew the exact shot language that the show works in. Like, it's one thing to watch the show and it's another to be like, you know, itemized list of like every shot that they use and realize, oh, they never use clean singles. It's all, they're always dirty or whatever those little details are, you know, just as a for instance. And I thought that was really smart.
I think the interesting thing about directors, especially in TV, is they're not so much responsible for what the final episode is as opposed to like gathering the building blocks for the episode. So if you know how a show is shot, then you become very valuable as a person that knows the type of things to gather for that show, you know?
Absolutely. And every show has a different degree of how much they want a director to make those creative decisions and how much they want the material they need to cut the show the way they'd like to cut it.
Enough about your success. You went from zero to like a bazillion in during a pandemic, which is very impressive. So when I met you, I started saying this, you know, at Matt's baby shower, you told me about the short film you made in film school at Chapman, right? That ended up getting you a Student Academy Award. And I thought it was really fascinating just what it was about, how you came up with it, why you told that story. And obviously, I'm sure it was instrumental in kind of launching your career. So as kind of like a story of things that our listeners, especially people that are newer filmmakers and trying to figure out like what's the thing they can do to be noticed, I think your example is like this perfect story.
When I started at Chapman, I had a fairly strong understanding of directing, working with actors. I had very little technical skills when it comes to filmmaking. So I tried to make my years at Chapman about understanding camera and editing and all the craft things about filmmaking I knew very little about. The first week of film school, they have an orientation where they show past student films that were great. And one of the ones they showed is directed by someone who I'm now very close friends with, a director named Sarah Thacker. And it was a period piece, World War II musical that was almost 40 minutes long, called The Bright Side. Highly recommend this short film to anyone who wants to see what just like a superb short film can be. I remember sitting there watching it and thinking, this woman has set the bar and I will spend the next 3 years trying to reach it.
And this is grad school?
This is grad school.
Okay. So you had a background in working with actors or theater or?
Yeah, that's a whole other long story. When I was in college, I tried to study abroad in London and take some film classes. And I accidentally got placed at this very historic and traditional British drama school. And I was there as a director, but they didn't let me do much directing. I basically was just forced into the acting program, which was like 12 hours a day, 5 to 6 days a week, ballet, Shakespeare, Meisner. It was the most insane time of my life. So I had no experience before that. And then it was...
Wait, so just to clarify, you were like, I'm going to go study abroad and learn how to direct, to be a director. And then they're like, no, Brenna, you are at Hogwarts, but also you have to take ballet and Meisner instead.
Sorry, you're Slytherin, not Hufflepuff.
Yeah.
What's did you have to pay for this school that put you in the wrong major?
So I actually didn't go to learn directing. I thought I was going to go take some film theory classes and then, like every other college student, party it up.
Sure.
The entire time. That was not what happened. I don't know. I still don't know if it was a paperwork error or what, but this was a school that like, they told me 4,000 people auditioned each year for 15 acting spots and 5 directing spots. And I was just there with zero acting or directing experience amongst these young British people who had like sacrificed everything to be there.
Wait, did you have to audition?
No, I was there like one exchange student of the year. I guess they took one.
You know
one.
That there's like a British Brenna Malloy right now that's like
just
you
so
know,
mad.
Janitor at a,
just so mad.
At a kindergarten that's like, I hate her. What happened to my spot?
Yeah, it's a mirror. It's the biggest gift I've ever been given was my time there.
You accidentally took a crash course in acting.
So after Hogwarts, showed up at Chapman and I knew that I wanted to make something that had production value. And I sort of was watching all these short films and thinking, really, I should take stock of what I have access to. Now, this first year of film school, knowing that I want to make something for my thesis that's extraordinary.
Sorry to interrupt you, but Like, what do you mean by has production value? Like, what does that mean to you as a student filmmaker?
So, like, I think anything you have access to for free that would cost most people money is production value. I had a parent who was a nurse. Before COVID, I would have access to a hospital. That's mm-hmm. production value.
Or you're a martial artist or right. whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Any sort of view into a world that most people don't know, and you can access locations or props or people that would normally be very expensive.
Before you continue, Brenna, the other thing I want to point out is the phrase you used was that you intended to make something extraordinary, right? And that's a thing that, like, I think as filmmakers, we all implicitly want to do that. No one's like, well, I want to make kind of like a mediocre, like down the middle film. No one ever says that. And no one ever thinks that. But to explicitly say, like, no, I want my movie to be extraordinary. I want it to be fucking awesome is a way of, not to get too woo-woo, but it is a way of manifesting, right? It is a way of setting intentions and making it clear to people, like, no, I want this to be awesome. And, you know, I don't know that, you know, 23-year-old Brenna was like, my thesis is going to be extraordinary, but it wouldn't surprise me if you did say that, right? And I think that that's a thing, owning that you want your films to be good and that you're telling everyone that they are going to be good or that you intend to make them good, and that here are all the ways in which you're going to do that, I think is a thing that, knowing you personally, is a trend with you and is a thing that I think people can start doing right away. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. But when I look back at that time, no part of me was confident about this endeavor. What my time in London gave me is it revealed to me the depth of my ignorance. And so I went directly from that into film school, having zero confidence in myself, but knowing that the work is what matters and everything else is on the side. And so I think the strive for something extraordinary was to hit a note for myself about the process, not so much about the film being extraordinary.
And I love your definition of production value, and it's a great way to think about it. I'm guilty of many times thinking like, wow, I have access to this amazing thing. Like my brother, he was a music student at Cal State Long Beach for 5 years, and he knew everyone. And he like had he was part of the orchestra. He was a double major and part of like this big choir. And I was always like, oh, I could get like a whole orchestra for free and shoot at this place for free. And that would be, if I paid for that, and be so expensive, you know? The smart filmmaker capitalizes on that, which probably segues into what you did next.
Back to how it came to be, my great-grandfather, Emmett Malloy, ran a dirt racetrack in Inglewood, California, in the 40s and 50s, and my grandfather, Tom, was a little kid running around this track, obsessed with racing and these drivers. And this was at a time, racing's always been dangerous, but this was at a time where they had like lap seat belts and like leather helmets. I mean, right. People perished.
90%, yeah.
At these races.
Survival rate. Yeah.
And so anyway, my grandfather grew up, and him and my grandma got married, and they struggled financially for a long time. And then when my dad was a kid, my grandpa started a business, a construction business in LA. And he's a very frugal man, but when the business started doing well, he started collecting the cars that raced at his dad's track. And so flash forward to me as a kid, I grew up going with him to vintage races, sitting in these cars from the 40s and 50s, daydreaming about what it was like back then. And so that was really the genesis of this story, is what would it be like for a woman back then to inherit her father's racing legacy. And I asked him if I could use his cars, his cherished possessions that he spent years putting together and caring for, and was fully expecting him to say no. And he said yes. And he was my biggest supporter, letting me use those cars.
Wow. And what about the location?
That's another good story. The location was actually his brother's ranch in Lompoc, California, that I grew up going to the, he did a pumpkin patch every year. So I asked his brother if he'd be open to it. And he said he wanted to read the script first. And he read it and said no.
That's pretty awesome.
Because it was like,
unless there's a role for me, Brenna.
No, I think it had feminist undertones. And then he read it again and he realized it was very much about the father-daughter dynamic. Mm-hmm. And there's a sweet story there because my grandpa and his brother didn't have the best relationship my whole life, but they came together to help me make Rocket and they repaired their brotherhood and reconciled after all those years. And then he ended up dying, you know, a couple years after that. So it was a really amazing thing for my family to make this film.
I bet that just crushes at Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Like Brenna mended the family and won an Oscar.
It does not crush because I have, like,
who cares? What's an Oscar? Oh, Chicago yeah. PD.
Yeah. I have, you know, relatives that have done much more than me, let's say. So.
So did you build the racetrack on this ranch? Like, did you get a production designer to dig a track? How does that work?
So my production designer was Rama Farahat, who I went to Chapman with, who's a wonderful designer who's working as an art director right now. And she and I went up there and talked about everything. And we talked with my grandpa's brother, and my grandpa and him worked together to make the track exactly how we wanted it. He took a tractor out there and graded it, and it was a team effort.
Wow. And you built like stands and all the elements that go?
Rocket is, there's so little there. If you take a second look at it, everything we had, we put in the frame. There's no stands. There's three extras. I mean, it was so sparse, which was such a challenge for us. The one thing we did is we built a huge scoreboard, and that helped tell a lot of the story at the track.
What I love about that, though, is that it's literally you're using the elements that you have. Like you're saying, you had enough plywood to make a scoreboard, a few friends to come be extras, a car and a space to shoot, basically.
And did you hire stunt drivers?
So this is another good story. Years before, someone had used one of the cars in my grandpa's collection for a commercial. And the stunt coordinator of that commercial and my grandpa hit it off. That man ended up being Andy Armstrong, who stunt coordinated the Spider-Mans and Green Hornet and a bunch of other big movies. And I had no idea when I cold called him that he actually was a huge support of female directors and female stunt coordinators. So I cold called him out of the blue just for advice. And that call turned into a mentorship, turned into a friendship, turned into him and his wife, Jen, coming out, and Jen stunt coordinated the movie out of the goodness of her heart, and Andy helped her. So I just lucked into this amazing opportunity to work with like two huge people in the stunt world.
That's crazy.
Had Jen coordinated before?
Jen had coordinated before, not to the level mm-hmm. Andy had, but Jen is a very accomplished stunt woman and stunt mm-hmm. coordinator.
I guess the thing I'm actually asking is, like, I think oftentimes it's really helpful to like incentivize crew members in other ways. And sometimes a credit can be meaningful, right? So like if she was looking for more coordinator credits, that can be a way of paying her without spending cold hard cash, for instance.
I think she was looking for coordinator credits. But with that being said, the amount of money a stunt person can make in a day on anything sure. is compared to doing a student film for nothing. They're the nicest people in the world, and I will forever be indebted to them for doing this.
To rewind a tiny bit about like why you chose to make this movie, obviously you have the family history and the connection, and you found a personal story, which is, like, to me, what is so great about this is a lot of times I think how you know, you see these really interesting stories from people that have really unique backgrounds. And then I sometimes think of myself and I'm like, I'm just this guy from Orange County. I grew up in the suburbs. Like, I have my story, but it's kind of very familiar. How do I mine my life for something that can stand out, that can be extraordinary, that can move people in a way that they haven't been moved before? That's what I really like about your story, that you found, you know, this is your great grandfather's story and you put like your inquisitiveness into his world, which I think is just a cool way into making something original, you know?
It's cool hearing you say that. I've done very little reflecting about it, but it was just a marriage of everything you've just said, of like putting a passion I have in my own family history to the question of what is a love story that has a happy ending, but they don't end up together. That's where I came at it as a director and as a writer.
The other thing, like, that you mentioned production value, you mentioned seeing this incredible short film that inspired you to up your game, you know, from a directorial standpoint. Can you tell us a little bit about like what drew you to make action sequences and also how you approached them as a new person that, I mean, I'm assuming you probably hadn't filmed a ton of car races before that?
I hadn't. My DP, Nick Ramsey, who's wonderful, and the rest of our crew, we would get together each week leading up to shooting this, and we'd watch a racing movie.
It's like Fast and Furious 1.
We did. We watched, I think we watched Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift. We watched that. We watched Talladega Nights. We watched Le Mans. We watched Rush.
Rush is pretty great. Rush didn't get enough attention, honestly.
Rush is a really good movie.
It's Ron Howard, right?
It's Ron Howard. And really, we kind of tapped into this thing that photographing racing is really challenging outside of the obvious reasons of the mechanics of like having a vehicle move fast and having a camera move fast along with it. When you're making a movie about something really niche, like racing, if you honor the racing, the story tends to fall by the wayside. And when you honor the story, the reality of the racing falls by the wayside. And so that prep kind of helped us tap into how we wanted to attack the racing sequences visually with no money. And I always wanted to do it practically. And so we kind of put our heads together, and Andy and Jen came up with an idea to craft our own process trailer so that we could pull the vintage cars up onto it and the front wheels would be attached and the back wheels would be moving practically, so that when you filmed the actor, the car was actually moving, the wheels were moving. I had no experience doing this.
Time out. Hold on.
It's like you're towing the car.
Towing a car. Yeah, yeah. But are you using, you're not using a tow truck. What are you?
We are using my dad's old Suburban to tow a homemade process trailer towing the car.
Now that I mention it, though, hearing it out loud, people will use a tow as like a process trailer. That is a thing that people will use sometimes.
Right. Even like a U-Haul. One. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the wheels are high, right? When you tow a car at an angle, you put just the front wheels on like the U-Haul tower, then it's angled, right?
So did the Suburban work better? Was it level, basically?
The Suburban towed a trailer that was very low to the ground, and we pulled the car up onto the trailer that had holes for the front tires to dip down into so that it was relatively level. And because these cars, the engines in them, we had to get very specific stunt people to drive them. Actors would never be able to drive these without intense training. So that was I still can't believe we pulled that off.
And are your actors, but you used actors because you were using the process trailer.
Yep. Everything that's close is our actors on the trailer. And then everything that's far is our stunt performers.
Cool. And then, you choreographed like the races.
It was a group effort. It was I co-wrote the script with Ian Hawk. And so it started there. And then when Andy became a part of it, really working with him to figure out how we could craft who takes over when, you know, especially the opening sequence where there's a crash. And so it was learning a lot from Andy and Jen, and then doing what we needed to hit those story points.
Cool. Okay, so you made this short film. Obviously, I'm assuming did you feel like it was pretty good when you were done with it?
No, I didn't. I didn't think it was bad, to be totally honest. I thought I can feel proud of this in terms of I won't be ashamed to show this to people. But I did not think it was good. And we submitted it to the Student Academy Awards when we submitted to every other festival because it was free to submit to Student Academy Awards.
Wait, and how do you do that? Does Chapman help you submit it?
No, at the time it was just through like Film Freeway or whatever the other one was.
I was going to say Chapman now is maybe the school that I feel like is the best at submitting short films to film festivals.
Really?
I meet more young Chapman filmmakers just like out and about. And I'm always like, what is going on? Where, like, I think that now they're like there's like a department that's very, very actively trying to get Chapman filmmakers out there. Whereas like USC doesn't help you at all, or at least didn't back when I was there. And I think it's still the case. Like, it's not crazy to see like, I don't know, like 25% of a short film program be Chapman students.
Wow.
It's bonkers. I was like, what is going on? Anyway.
There is someone who works there who there is like a film festival department. When we were working with them, they were great. But the Student Academy Awards was just like, it's just a button we clicked on Film Freeway. And then we found out there was like four different steps before finding out you won. And at one point we found out we were in the top 100 or something. And I was like, this is insane. All of us shocked, couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, we'll never make it any further, but what an honor to be in the top 100. And then it just kept dwindling further and further. And I'm still in shock. I still cannot believe it. And that entire experience completely changed my life.
So you became one of five nominees, or how did that work?
So at the time, I don't know if it's the same now, but at the time it was, there's three winners in each category, and there's gold, silver, and bronze. And we won bronze for narrative category.
Oh, cool. And so that's a Student Academy Award
for yep.
your short. And then did you do anything personally to kind of get out the word that you had won this award?
Nope. I did nothing at all except wonder what I was going to do next and try to make stuff. I did sign with a manager at this time who I've been with ever since. And I was very green about the industry then. And she started sending me on a lot of generals, which I was so bad at, just had no idea what I was doing or what to say to these people or that I should pitch something. And so that was the beginning of what led to TV, is just that process of trying to get the next thing going.
Well, and what happened, basically, what was the next big step after the Academy Awards? What was the next get?
So after Student Academy Awards, my next big thing was getting into the Ryan Murphy Half Initiative and shadowing on 911.
Right. And then after shadowing on 911, you did a few more programs. Is that correct?
After shadowing on 911, I made some shorts, was trying to better myself as a writer of features. And while I was doing that, I was applying to every program there is. I got an interview with Female Forward, the NBC program, the first year they did it. And I made it to the interview round, which that year they had said was they were interviewing, I want to say like 30 to 50 people out of 1,000 applicants. So when I learned I had made it into that. It didn't give me confidence, but it gave me hope that I was onto something. Did terrible in the interview. Absolutely awful. Could not have done worse.
Do you remember? Can you give an example of like a bad thing you did in the interview?
Yes. They asked me, what do you need to most work on as a director, or what's your weakness? And I said, the tone of my voice.
What did you mean by that, though? What were you getting at?
I don't know. I think because when I was in this drama school with all these people who had this like perfect, like they had these perfect voices because they did so many vocal exercises and whatever. I'd always been so self-conscious of like having vocal fry and like just not.
Yeah.
You know, in an interview setting, even in a setting like this, this isn't my normal tone of voice and I have no control over it. And so.
Yeah, that's a bad answer. That's a pretty bad
it's
answer.
Terrible. It's terrible.
It's interesting, and I think.
But that's not like.
It's not what they wanted to hear.
They wanted to hear.
It doesn't seem related to directing.
That's another way of saying, like, what do you want to work on? Where do your ambitions lie? How self-aware of your skill set are you?
Right. And what's important to you?
Yeah.
You know what? I think I'm not ordering this right, because I actually think this first female forward interview came before shadowing for the Half Initiative, because I didn't get it that first year for obvious reasons. And then I shadowed at 911 and did a couple of other things. And when I came back to interview again the following year, and this time I did something smart, which was actually prepare for the interview. They had liked that I had done things to better myself as a director in the year.
In between.
So, yeah.
I think the point that I am almost always trying to make when we have conversations with people who have great TV careers and have shadowed is that it's very common, I think maybe unanimously true, that you do multiple programs. Maggie Kiley, Hannah Lee Culpepper. So a bunch of people who just, you know, shadow like crazy, basically, and then finally get that first episode. I do have one final question before we go into unpaid endorsements. And that's, what do you do next, right? You've done 13 episodes of television, and they're in the procedural world, right? So like that's like one very particular style of television. Is it, do you want to expand into other types? Do you want to do features? Are you like, no, I'm just going to, you know, become a producing director on one of these shows and like live that life? Now that you've really jumped into the deep end, what do you see as that next step for yourself?
In an ideal world, I'd like to start producing directing. I don't see any immediate, you know, like it's going to happen soon, but I think my work speaks for itself and it's been going well, and knock on wood, it continues to go well. Those jobs are hard to get, and they're especially hard to get in the city we live in. That would be a great next step for me. I'd also at some point like to make a first feature, and maybe down the road direct pilots. It's something that I think I've learned in the last 2 years, that when I'm directing an episode I feel really passionate about, when the script speaks to me, it makes me come alive as a director. And when I direct an episode where the script doesn't speak to me very much, it's really challenging to stay focused. And so it's motivated me to dive back into the stuff I was writing before doing TV, because I think I'll need, as time goes on, if I keep getting opportunities like this, I will need a better balance of the type of work I do in order to sustain myself.
Yeah, I do feel like there is a point in everyone's career where we have that moment of like, oh, this is it. This is what the job is. This is what I worked for. And like, unless you're doing like huge, huge studio movies, there's room to move up, right? But like, I think the realities of the job sort of hit you at a certain point, and you kind of have to decide, like, do I want to keep going? You know,
I definitely want to keep going. I mean, I can't believe what I get to do. Like, you know, last week I was doing an episode where I showed up on set and we had turned an empty building into a full grocery store. The entire thing was set dressed as a grocery store. And there was five fire trucks and a SWAT, you know, van and 10 cop cars and 40 actors and a whole crew.
It is incredible, certainly. And I'm not taking anything for granted. You're living the dream. But I guess what I'm saying is that once you realize that dream, you know, you realize it completely, fully, you know, the good and the bad is all I was getting at.
It's true. There's challenges of working at this pace. Absolutely. Both in life and in work. It's hard to be gone this much of the year. I've learned that when I'm having those really tough moments of like, why am I doing this? Why have I set myself up for this feeling? And it happens at least one day every episode. I have this routine where right when I get off set, I go to bed and then I get up like at 2-3 in the morning and I work for 3-4 hours before a day of shooting, going over the plan for the day. And there's some days where I'm in that 4 a.m. hour, like on my second cup of coffee, knowing I'm being picked up in an hour and not having it in me to get through the day, where I'm like, why have I chosen this life for myself?
Yeah. And then you go blow up a grocery store. And
yeah, exactly.
Life is pretty good.
But I mean, that's, I think, part of being an artist is you're constantly asking yourself why you're doing this.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Chicago Brenna, do you have a few more minutes to endorse with us?
I do.
Unpaid endorsements.
All right. Well, I had a different endorsement, but I'm going to save it for later because you've inspired me, Brenna. All this talk of the world of old-fashioned racing and also your point about the balance between the nature of the race and the nature of story and how to kind of strike that balance reminded me of one of my all-time favorite old This American Life episodes. It's episode 279, Auto Show, Act 5. It's called The End of the Road, specifically. And it is about the story of a reporter, Dan Neal, who's like an automotive critic for the LA Times. He tells the story of Sterling Moss, who was a race car driver who at the time was 75 and held the world record for completing a 1,000-mile race called the Mille Miglia, which is just like an old-fashioned hardcore race, right? They're just racing through the countryside and the race lasts for 10 hours. This reporter rides with this old-fashioned old man, basically, in the car, in the Mercedes that he won that race in, basically. And it just becomes this kind of lyrical, romantic story about the nature of racing. And as a person who's not especially interested in sports overall or racing, I've revisited it over the years many, many times. It's just like, it's lyrical, it's introspective, it brings new understanding to what racing is and the nature of practice and all sorts of stuff. So End of the Road, Act 5, episode 279, Auto Show on This American Life is my endorsement. And now, it's been a long time since I've listened to the show, you can just listen to that act. You just have to like scrub through the episode to find it. But that's my endorsement.
Is it my turn?
It is your turn, Brenna. What you got?
Okay, I have two things. I hope that's okay. The first one is a film tool that I've actually used on my last two episodes. I don't think it's new, but it's new to me and it was new to the shows. I used it for the first time at Chicago PD and then I just used it at Chicago Fire. And it's called a F-27 telescopic crane. It's essentially a very lightweight crane that can arm out over 25 feet, and the entire unit weighs with the camera and the camera head weighs about 500 pounds. And it can live on its own dolly, or it can live on like a Fisher dolly or a Chapman dolly. What it's great for is interior crane moves, which aren't really needed very much. And it has to be the right moment. But on both of my last two episodes, we had the need for an interior crane move. And we probably could have somehow gotten a techno crane into the Chicago Fire set. But there's no way we could have got it on the Chicago PD set because it's a bullpen that's like raised. You have to go upstairs to get to that bullpen set. And it was just a really cool lightweight crane. Jason Strathorn on Chicago PD recommended it. They had been wanting to try it. I said, why not? Let's give it a shot.
Is it also skinny enough to get through doorways really easily?
Yes.
It's very cool.
Yes, it gets through doorways really well. Highly recommend if the grip team is up for it.
Can I ask you, like, we needed an interior crane shot. Like, is that something that you wanted or like you actually needed it?
In this case, it was both. Every show has a different need for a director to push things visually. And at Chicago PD, they've really encouraged the directors to be as dynamic as possible with the camera. I described the shot I wanted to the producing director, and then the DP and Key Grip got involved and they recommended this tool. So it was came from a place of me wanting to do a shot the producing director liked, and then the team figuring out how to make it work. My second thing is the backpack that has gotten me through 13 episodes of TV, and I don't have the heart to replace because it's in perfect condition still, because it's such a great backpack. And it's by Peak Design, which I believe started as a camera bag company and was so popular that they expanded into backpacks and duffels. And this is the 20-liter everyday backpack, which is incredibly durable and perfectly designed. And you can change the size of all the compartments within. Best backpack ever.
Cool. That's really good recommendations. Mine are going to not be good. First, I'm going to add an addendum to last week's recommendation, the Elote chips from Trader Joe's. I really endorsed them quite aggressively last week. And I did realize today that some people might think they're a little too spicy. So if you're not into spicy stuff, maybe skip them. I ate an entire bag of them again today. My dad bought me 3 bags at Trader Joe's and I have none left.
I've had them and I can't buy them because I'll eat the whole bag immediately.
Oh, see, Matt, I feel like there was some doubt.
Dude, I'm ready. I just don't go to Trader Joe's.
Anyway, also kind of inspired by Brenna, not the traditional endorsement, but not inspired by Brenna specifically, but by our conversation of deciding how long we should struggle for and all that stuff is I've been saying no to a lot of things recently, a lot of jobs, a lot of things that don't seem quite right for me and maybe losing out on money and maybe losing out on work, but being pretty happy that I have like a weekend to do the things I want to do. And in this industry, you know, there's a lot of hustle and you're constantly fighting to get jobs and it's all about the work and you're, you know, on set for 60 days, 16 hours a day or whatever, drawing storyboards that no one will ever shoot. Like, it's exhausting. And so it's okay to say no every once in a while, especially if the job does not seem at all interesting to you.
Can I ask you a follow-up question about that?
Sure.
Do you think those decisions you've been making saying no will pay off because the time you have away from the work actually strengthens you? You have a deeper well to pull from when you come back?
Having time to breathe for a second or to just like not be stressed out has been helpful for me. And yeah, I got offered this pretty awesome job that paid really well with this company I love and a team I love, but the content was just not really something that like, I've been trying to focus my career more recently and work on things that I think either I love right now or it's just incredibly obvious for me how this job will lead to the next job, whether it's a producer I really want to work with or a brand or a type of genre or an actor. I find that directing just for the money is really draining because directing is all consuming and it takes
so hard.
Yeah. It takes a lot of work and you have to be worried about everything all the time. And so I'd rather do other things just for money and direct also for money, but just be a little more selective. And I think a lot of people, especially people that are starting out or that have their own production companies, like have this instinct to just say yes to every single thing because we all know, and we've heard the story on the podcast a million times, like this job that you had no interest in, that had no budget, ended up leading to this amazing opportunity. Like that stuff does happen and it is true. I don't know. I think just saying no is powerful too. So I might have talked about this recently on the podcast, but I'm doubling down on it.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you.
I think you did, but it bears repeating for sure. And I'll try those chips one of these days, Oren.
You better.
Well, Brenna, thank you so much. How can listeners keep track of your exploits and all of your wonderful television directing and your future endeavors?
IMDb.
Perfect. That's a good answer. Brenna Malloy on IMDb. If you have thoughts or questions about the show, if you want us to forward a question along to Brenna, you can hit us up at justshootapod@gmail.com. Or if you just want to tweet at us, that's another way, or Instagram. We're across all social media at justshootapod. And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow.
And I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram. I'm at Smitey Pyleg on Twitter. And this episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. The music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And rate us on iTunes if you get a chance. We appreciate it. And we'll catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.